Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Carlos Ira. He is the T.L. Riggs Professor of History and Religious Studies at Yale University. And we're talking about his new book, They Flew, A History of the Impossible. Carlos, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, thanks for inviting me to be on the show.
This is a very unique book. And part of the reason I chose it is I really wanted to see what you came up with. This is a book about religious figures, mostly Catholic and Protestant, who levitated and bilocated. How did you start to get into this, Carlos?
Yes. Well, you know, started a very long time ago, in childhood, basically. But the book itself, I got the idea for it 40 years ago.
Wow.
Actually, this summer will be 41 years ago. I didn't write continuously for 41 years. I'd only began to write fairly recently. Most of the book was written during the COVID plague. So it's been bubbling up for a long time. And I did a little bit of research, you know, through the years, but it really came together in the last 2.5 years or so.
Well, you write at the beginning of the book that you were on a tour of a Carmelite convent of Incarnation,
right,
in 1983. And they were, you know, giving you a typical tour. And then all of a sudden, the idea of levitation came up, and you were just, and they just sort of matter-of-factly talked about that and then moved on. And then you were just struck, like, wait a minute, that's a big deal.
Yeah, and it was a big deal because I had been thinking about it for years. But the fact that this tour guide pointed to the spot in the convent where St. Teresa had levitated together with another saint, St. John of the Cross, as a matter of fact, you know, here's the staircase, here's the kitchen, and here's the spot where the two levitated for the first time, she added. I thought, wow, this is just, I looked and over the years, and I kept finding more and more narratives, or let's put it even more succinctly, testimonies. People who claim to have witnessed such events. I stuck with it because for two reasons. One, levitation in certain circumstances is very difficult to fake. I mean, magicians and so-called illusionists perform levitations on stage all the time, and it looks real. But we're talking about the 16th and 17th century, and we're talking about very, very tightly enclosed spaces in some cases. And in other cases, we're talking about outdoors, where it would be, talk about impossible, it would be impossible to rig up wires and so on as they do on stage. So I stuck with it.
It is interesting because within this narrative that you have of these stories of levitation and bilocation, is the larger question about how do we understand these testimonies, these people who have written about these events happening a long time ago. As you write in the book, how is it possible to speak about something that can't possibly happen? And where are the facts, and how do we define truth and facts? And those, and especially in the epilogue, this becomes a really important issue about faith and understanding.
Yes, it is about faith, but it's also about testimonies and about facts. And as a historian, I decided that these testimonies cannot be dismissed offhand.
And that's the that's the important word right there, is offhand.
Right, offhand. Right. And having an assumption or sort of a precondition that these things simply cannot happen when we have so many testimonies of it happening struck me as, poor history, doing history poorly, dismissing testimonies, especially because there are so many of them, and the circumstances under which the testimonies were given were such that it's actually more difficult to prove that all of these hundreds of people are lying, I think.
Well,
to prove that they might, you know.
We don't know.
Yeah, we don't. We don't.
I'm not a person who believes these stories right out of hand, and I read the book with real interest. But I do know when you're talking about testimonies from several hundred years ago, especially people in a state of aesthetic, intensity, that I don't know if we can trust narratives.
Yeah, well, I don't trust narratives 100%, no matter what the narratives are.
I got that feeling.
Yeah, I like to be skeptical throughout the entire spectrum of credibility. You know, I like to be skeptical on this question. I like to be skeptical about the events themselves.
Yep.
But I also like to be skeptical about the offhand dismissal of testimonies.
What is great about your research is that you just present all the information that we know about it. And there's an awful lot to read about. So we should talk about from the beginnings. Let's define levitation and bilocation. How would you define levitation?
Levitation is a momentary suspension of the law of gravity surrounding a person, so that the person floats, rises up into the air at various heights. Some levitators actually literally flew hundreds of feet.
Well, as you mentioned, outside they went almost out of view.
Yes, in some cases, yes. Or up onto the top of a tree.
Now,
and inside up to the ceiling, a very tall ceiling.
And bilocation is a much more complex phenomenon.
Yes, it is, because it's the phenomenon where a person in one place remains in that place, but is seen and interacted with in another, sometimes at great distances.
Huge distances. So,
yes. In the case of one of my...
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a bit. And this is also an interesting book about the history of Protestantism and Catholicism. Mm-hmm. Because as you write extensively in the book, and I want to mention, this is a scholarly book. This is a really wonderful book to read. The Protestant Reformation led to a redefinition of the concepts of religion, magic, superstition, and idolatry. And that's a quote from your book. So what's fascinating to me is that the cases of levitation didn't cross that barrier. There was still levitation within it after the Protestant Reformation, but it was usually associated with witches and devils.
That's right. And this is one of the weird characteristics of the transition from the Middle Ages to modernity, is precisely this, that the Protestant Reformation, and this covers all of the various different churches that emerged in the Protestant Reformation. All of them denied the possibility of divine miracles.
Right. Can you just elaborate on why that would be?
Yeah, two reasons. First, this teaching in Protestantism came to be known as the cessation of miracles.
Yeah.
Miracles ceased around the year 100, when the last of the 12 apostles died.
Huh.
The reason for denying their existence, there are theological reasons, and then there are very practical, pragmatic reasons. Let's begin with the pragmatic ones, because they're easier to understand. The Catholic Church claimed so many miracles as proof of the fact that it was the true church, that honestly, in this very I'm actually struggling for the adjective in this very contentious period where the churches are all calling each other false. Protestants needed to say, no, miracles are not a proof that your church is true, because the devil also tricks people into thinking that they're seeing miracles. And it became a polemical weapon on both sides. Catholics would say, ha ha, look, we have miracles, you don't. Protestants would say to the Catholics, no, your miracles are not miracles at all. They're just demonic tricks. So ironically, while Protestants rejected a lot of Catholic theology, they accepted nearly 100% Catholic demonology.
Jeez.
In the case of Protestants, they wouldn't say levitation is impossible.
They just say it's on the wrong side.
That's right, yes. And the Catholics also had the wrong side, too. The Catholics, not everybody who levitated was certified as a divinely inspired or a divinely caused levitation. That could also be demonic for Catholics. But Protestants went that way with the devil.
There's so much in your book. We're going to barely scratch the surface in this little conversation. The New Testament, there's no cases of levitation.
No.
So is it really an Old Testament phenomenon?
Even in the Old Testament, it's very, very few instances. It's one of these miracles or wonders that existed before Christianity. It's levitation and bilocation are very common in Asian religions. There are also cases of levitation in Islam. But actually, most of my colleagues who work on Asian religions, when I explained what I was working on, were not the least bit impressed. they said, of course, this is one of the earmarks.
That old levitation stuff. I can't believe you're doing that. It's been done too much. Now, let's talk about these cases of Catholic levitation and bilocation. It's often associated, and I would say mostly associated, with extreme asceticism. So it's not just coming out of the blue, although sometimes it does. For instance, Saint Francis of Assisi levitated and rose to, quote, great heights, but he actually radiated a glow, and that's reported in several of the cases.
Yes. There are various physical phenomena that have been linked to mystical ecstasy.
Yeah.
And Francis, of course, not only levitated and bilocated, but he is actually the first to receive the stigmata. These are the wounds of Christ on his body, in his hands, feet, and sides. So that miracle had not occurred before. And suddenly with him, there it is. And the same thing with levitation. You begin to see it in the Middle Ages, early Middle Ages.
Yeah.
And then it just, after Francis, so after, let's say, the 12th, 13th century, it becomes much more common as a side effect of mystical ecstasy. And mystical ecstasies in the Catholic tradition don't happen without having a life full of self-denial and constant prayer.
I find unlike other things within the church, there's both male and female levitators. And as a fact, you have some great stories of people like Saint Teresa of Avila. And that was an amazing. She went into a trance, and actually, the great thing about Saint Teresa is she didn't really like those events at all.
No, and principally for two reasons. And this is how complicated this phenomenon becomes, even within Catholicism.
Oh, yeah.
One is the possibility of demonic levitation. She feared people might be thinking that this is being done by the devil, and that she will obviously get into trouble, as many other nuns did with the Inquisition in Spain. And the other is that humility is one of the chief virtues with which the inquisitors judge whether someone's mystical ecstasies are divine or demonic. So the humbler you are, the more likely it is that these are of divine origin. But in her day and age, there were other nuns, you know, claiming these phenomena. And many of them were, of course, suspected of being influenced by the devil.
Well, for good reason, and we'll talk about that later, that are included in your book. But when we talk about St. Teresa, and you happen to mention the Inquisition, they played a role in sort of judging the veracity of these. At times, they did.
Yes.
So.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they, I mean, the Inquisition is a powerful cudgel. And wouldn't it behoove somebody to act very.
Well, since humility was so important.
Yeah.
In the monastic Catholic tradition, levitating or bilocating and having people venerate you as a living saint, that's problematic.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, you basically have to stay humble. Teresa also asked for the levitations to stop.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
They hurt physically. Her body always hurt afterwards. So she asked, and her prayers were answered, she says, in her autobiography, which was written in 1562, she says, yes, and God heard my prayers, and they have stopped. But later on, like 10 years later, they returned.
Huh.
But you don't see that in her autobiography. You have to look at other documents written by her, especially a couple of letters that she wrote where she says, oh, they've returned, but not as frequently.
There's St. Joseph of Cupertino.
Yeah.
And that case is weird because when he levitated, all his robes and stuff like looked like they were frozen.
Yeah.
Like a suspension of time. And the thing is, it happened often when he was at the altar. So this whole thing had a sort of an interesting interplay with beliefs of transubstantiation.
Oh, yes. In a matter of
fact, he was one of the ones that could vanish outside if he was out of doors.
He's the most frequent levitator and the most extreme levitator that I encountered. And I searched high and low, no pun intended. I searched, but he's the most extreme. And the thing about Joseph of Cupertino is that one of his levitations actually converted a Protestant prince. And precisely while he was saying Mass, consecrating the Eucharist, he went up, as he often did, according to many, many, many eyewitness testimonies. And this Protestant prince from Saxony converted to Catholicism as a result. But I suspect that prince was already thinking about converting. Otherwise, why would he be in Italy attending a Catholic Mass, right? News traveled fast about Joseph of Cupertino. I think he probably heard about him or read about him and went down to see for himself.
But you're right, he's poorly known today.
Oh, yeah. He's, you know, in some Catholic circles, he is known as, obviously, the patron saint of people who fly. You know, anyone who gets in an airplane. And also the patron saint of exam takers, and that's a long story. But I remember not that many years ago when newspapers had personal ads, there were a lot of personal ads thank you, Joseph Cupertino, for helping me pass my exam.
Now, in all fairness, and your book is very even-handed, you also present several amazing cases of people who were discovered to be frauds.
Yeah.
And those stories are just as amazing. They're just as wild. There was the lady in blue who made claims that she was bilocating between Europe and North America and making converts, and she was found out by the Inquisition.
There were actually several nuns too, not the lady in blue. She's a specific case, but there were other nuns at this very same time claiming that they were acting as missionaries in other continents.
Yeah. Now, at that time, that is a very tough miracle to prove, just because of the distances and how long it took for people to find out information. But the problem with Maria, and by the way, I want to mention some of the titles of your chapters are hilarious. The problem with Maria is she just didn't know when to stop, because she really went over the top. I know it sounds weird to talk about somebody levitating going over the top. But she started saying that she had intimate relationships with the Virgin Mary. She wrote a book on Mary. And as a matter of fact, that book was given to Casanova. What a wild story that is.
Yeah, well, Casanova was briefly imprisoned in Venice. And the only book that they had to give him to read was this book written by Maria de Agreda. She claimed, the result of constant visitations or apparitions of the Virgin Mary, who narrated her autobiography to her. So actually, this book that Casanova found just completely insane. He had nothing nice to say about it or its author. He thought, this is just so ridiculous. But Maria de Agreda claimed that the Virgin Mary narrated not only her entire life, but also the life of Jesus and the apostles and of the early decades of the Christian church. And it's almost like a fifth gospel. It has many, many details that can't be found anywhere else, much less in the New Testament. The book brought her into the Inquisition's the large net they cast.
Oh yeah,
she fell into the net by not only levitating and by locating, but writing this book, which at one point she was ordered by one of her superiors to burn, and she obeyed and she burned it. But then another superior came along and said, what where's that book you wrote? I said, oh no, I was ordered by so and so to burn it. He says, well, start again. And it's a million words long.
Wow.
It's enormous.
Now, what was fascinating is how the Inquisition treated her, because I thought for sure that she'd be put to the painful question, but she wasn't. She was just, you know, she had to go to a convent and just never come out again.
Yep. But she also, Maria de Agreda, the folk story in the American Southwest about Maria de Agreda, where she's known as the Lady in Blue because this nun had a bluish kind of habit. Maria de Agreda also befriended the King of Spain. This king, King Philip IV, actually he's the one who befriended her, because he heard about her and went to visit her. And then for the remainder of their lives, they wrote letters to each other.
Jeez.
And, as you said, she didn't know where to stop. She actually became like a confidant or advisor to the king, who at that time was arguably the most powerful man on earth.
Wow.
So they wrote over 300 letters back and forth.
Are there people still today that believe that what she did was real?
Oh, yes. Yeah, many. Many Catholics do. And actually, in the American Southwest, she's such a legend that in San Angelo, Texas, a few years ago, not very many, like two or three, maybe four at most years ago, they erected a statue, a monument to the Lady in Blue. And her claim is, of course, that she visited these Native Americans over 500 times.
We're running out of time, and I want to mention the epilogue, I think, is almost a standalone piece about belief and science and the strategies of believing. It's really worth reading just in and of itself. You write that belief is the immortal soul of the imagination. And you talk about different strategies for believing. And it ends with, they flew. So you believe that they flew?
I think it's possible.
Okay.
I also say in the epilogue, you know, going back to the 16th and 17th century, where there's no film.
Yeah.
Of course, there's no way to prove it. You just have to believe the testimonies.
We've got to end there. I think this is an amazing book. My guest tonight is Carlos
Air.
Yeah. What a perfect name for this book. He's the T.L. Riggs Professor of History and Religious Studies at Yale University. And we've been just scratching this bare surface of this very rich book, They Flew, A History of the Impossible. Carlos, thank you so much for your time, and thanks for writing this book.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on the show.
You're listening to WICN.
Great honor.
Yeah, you're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.